And if you were upstairs this morning, you know that we're studying from the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 7. If you weren't upstairs this morning, you may not have been able to be a part of that study. But so I want to go back to that this morning. As we were reading 1 Corinthians chapter 7, each time I read it, what it does to me is it echoes predominantly the things that Jesus said back in the Gospels. When he said to the people of his day, "What God has joined together, let not man put asunder." And so Jesus' words coincides with Paul's words. He said, "Stay together. Stay together." Paul would say, "If you're believers, you're married, stay together. By all means, don't separate. If you have a believer married to unbeliever, stay together. By all means, don't let that marriage end, if all humanly possible." I don't know what the divorce rate was in first century among the Jews. It'd be interesting to know. They obviously had some problems, or it wouldn't have been talked about. And I don't know what the divorce rate was among the Gentiles in Corinth. Obviously, that was a challenge for those in Corinth, or Paul wouldn't have wrote about it. And I would be interested to know what the top 10 reasons were for divorce in the first century. Somehow, I suspect they may be similar to the ones given today. Here's where we are. Divorce rate today in America, nearly 50%. People debate that a little bit, 40 to 50, but usually people say it's about one out of every two marriages will end in divorce. If you do pursue more than one marriage, first marriage is usually 41% is where it's at. Second marriage, 60% will be divorced. And if you get into a third marriage, 73% of those will end in divorce. Odds get worse, don't they? It's interesting. And the top 10 reasons that are listed, and certainly these may be rearranged in some other study or may have something different, but this one at least said, number one is money problems. Number two, cheating, unfaithfulness. Number three, social networks. Had Facebook, maybe people getting involved with too much. I don't know but how that one, but it was interesting. Number four, addictions. Number five, lack of communication. Number six, abuse. Number seven, loss of interest, growing apart. Number eight, failure to have children. Number nine, careers get in the way. Number 10 is boredom. Like I said, I don't know if that would have been what you would have read if you read the paper or some of the statistics in the first century, but that's our statistics. I was reading about something that happened back in the 14th century called the Black Death. Ever heard of that? Bubonic plague ravaged Europe 1348-1350. Wiped out over between 40 and 60% of the population. Unbelievable. I'm afraid that our divorce rate rivals that. And the truth is, we really can't hold back that epidemic in our nation. We really can't. There's nothing we can do about it. It's like a train that's out of control. It's going to wreck. There's no way to stop it. Solomon wouldn't have put it that way. He would have said, "What's crooked can't be straightened." But you know what? We can minimize the impact of that on ourselves. Anyone here who has children, anyone who's married and has children, we want to do whatever we can to defy the odds that our children will ever experience that kind of tragedy. I believe an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, don't you? I believe in that cliche. So I want to give you a few things this morning. Obviously, when we read 1 Corinthians 7, what just impacts me is God doesn't want divorce. He doesn't want it. And he is encourages us to do whatever we can to make marriages work. So this isn't a nice, encouraging, uplifting sermon, sorry. But it deals with reality. We live in a tragic society. It's just a mess. But we don't want that to happen. We don't want that to invade this environment. This should be a different environment. And so some things to think about that would help, especially parents who have lots of children and they're wanting the best for them and hoping for the things to go well for them. That's something that we have to plan for. Here's some simple things that are helpful to prevent tragedy. Be careful who you marry. First thing I would say is marry a Christian. Marry a Christian. Now I want to tell you that there's no guarantee that that's going to avoid the tragedy. No guarantee that you won't divorce your mate at some point or your mate won't divorce you. It's no guarantee. But it certainly reduces the odds. And I say marry a strong Christian, not just somebody that got baptized, somebody that you can get in the water and get baptized. Marry somebody that's got a good track record. Marry somebody who has already demonstrated that they understand what faithfulness to keeping vows means. If they've been faithful to keeping their vows to the Lord, and they've demonstrated selflessness and sacrifice and commitment, then it's far more likely that they'll understand what that means to keep their vows to you. It's like an underwriting. They'll keep their vows to you. Somebody says, are you just saying we shouldn't marry a non-Christian? Nope. I'm saying you should marry a person who really is going to help you go to heaven. Someone you can look up to. Somebody you can rely on at times. Somebody says, well, that may mean I have to wait indefinitely for that. Well, maybe so. I would say the second thing is be careful. You don't have to marry at all. Now, that may turn the stomach of some people. But that's what Paul told the people in Corinth. At least in that particular circumstance, in those circumstances, he said, you know, there are situations where it'd be better if you just don't even get married. So he said in verse 25 and 26, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, and yet I'll give my judgment as one who has obtained mercy of the Lord to be trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it's good for man just to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek it to be loosed. He said, don't get a divorce if you're married, but if you're loose from a wife, don't seek a wife. It'd be better if you just stay single. You know, Jesus never married. Paul never married. Paul said it's not wrong to marry, but there are circumstances where it'd be better if you don't. A word to parents. We can push our children into prematurely setting out on a course to find a mate. By what we say or what we imply or permit, we may say, you know, if you don't get busy and get out there looking, you're going to end up an old maid. You better get out there and go. Look, you're going to miss out. And so with that in their minds, they set out looking, hunting for a spouse. And they either don't set their standards high enough or they're willing to lower them to whatever level to make sure they don't miss out. Paul would say it's better in some circumstances that you don't marry at all than to marry a lemon. Who likes when you buy a car and it turns out to be a lemon? Nobody wants to marry a lemon. Better not to marry at all than to marry and then get a divorce. So he would say that. He said that to the people in Corinth. It's something that we need to hear today. Focus on your marriage to Christ. Maybe a better advice than going out on the hunt, trying to find a spouse. Focus on your marriage to Christ. There's a book that we read called Let God Write Your Love Story. And the basic point of that was, while you're single, focus your effort on making yourself a bride for your spiritual husband. If you're a Christian, you're married to Christ. That image is certainly there. If we focus all of our energy and attention on making our character, making ourselves in the image of Christ, then when that other person comes along who's doing the same thing, they'll probably recognize you. They'll be attracted to you. And we need to let God be in the driver's seat on that. We don't maybe give Him some opportunity to bring us the person that's right for us rather than us feeling that we have to be in the driver's seat. We really don't trust God enough that He is intimately involved in our daily life. Some people think God wrote us His Word, gave us His wisdom, and then He kind of left us to Himself, to ourselves. That's about it. That's all He has to do with us. You know, push comes to shove, I've got to make this happen. Very self-reliant attitude. Very self-sufficient attitude. Go back and read Psalm 139. And read how David saw God as intimately involved in his life. Knew where he was, what he was doing, what he thought, what he was going to say before he ever said it. Has thousands of thoughts like the sands of the seashore about his life personally. To say God's not involved in our lives intimately, daily, it's just to say, I'm able to do it on my own. I'm independent. I can do it. Sorry. That's not the way that at least Bible men of faith live. We need to give God an opportunity to be the one in the driver's seat. Acts chapter 2 and verse 24, though this is certainly involves something else, whenever they were trying to cast lots to find an apostle to replace Judas, the spirit, the attitude, was the right attitude. When they said at the end of the chapter, they prayed and said, "You, O Lord," this is verse 24, "You know the hearts of all men. Show us which of these two You have chosen, that he might take part." The attitude was the right attitude. You know the hearts of all men. You be in the driver's seat rather than me, who has flawed judgments. To marry a non-Christian is to increase dramatically the possibility that you'll divorce one day. You need to recognize that no matter how much you may want to marry, your marriage to work. When you marry a non-believer, they may leave because they don't operate by the same principles that you do. Be careful who you marry. Second thing, make sure that they are committed to the biblical view of marriage. Make sure they are committed to the biblical view of marriage. Look in Matthew chapter 19. Turn to Matthew chapter 19. Pharisees had a running debate. Can we divorce for any reason? They came to Jesus. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Verse 3. Jesus said, no. He said, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man divide. He didn't say no because it's impossible. He didn't say no because you can't divorce your wife. He said it is not permitted to do it. It is not lawful. It is not what God said in Genesis 2. Jesus would not have said that you should not do something that you couldn't do. So they respond, they understand Jesus is prohibiting divorce, and they say, well, Moses said we could. Right? They go, it says, why then, verse 7, did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? Moses said we could. He said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. I like the other version that says, he suffered you to put away your wives. But that wasn't God's will. Genesis chapter 2, that's not what he was permitting. That's not what's authorized. And so he says, you listen to me. Here's what I say. And he is the voice that we have to listen to. Verse 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, verse 9, except for sexual immorality and marries another, commits adultery. Whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. That's the only reason that we can find the New Testament where God permits divorce. It's the only one. Would you be willing to commit to that in your marriage? That there is only one exception, one reason God would allow when two people marry for one to divorce the other. And that is when there was unfaithfulness, there was sexual immorality involved. That was so rigid. That was so narrow. Somebody says, oh, that's narrow. That's very narrow. But that was so rigid and so narrow and so out of sorts with common or current thinking that the disciples responded to that. They said, if such is the case in verse 10 of a man with his wife, it's just better not to marry. They said, well, that's so narrow. We just better not even get married. And Jesus said, okay, that's fine. That'd be fine. So, if you're thinking about getting married, and your spouse doesn't accept what Jesus says about this, that there's only one reason that you can divorce your mate, one reason that God will accept, and that's sexual immorality, it'd just be better not to get married. That's hard. That's not encouraging, is it? Sorry. But I tell you what, it'll certainly reduce the odds if that's the rule and you go by the rule that Jesus gave. It'll certainly reduce the odds that that will ever happen to you. Well, there's something else too, and that is that my happiness is not one of the exceptions to the rule. It's not us staying together is not contingent on my happiness. You know, today people make vows and they say till death do us part. But really, most people mean till death do us part as long as we're happy. As long as my marriage doesn't infringe on my happiness in some way. If my happiness is compromised, then therefore I have a right to break that commitment. You know, there are all kinds of things, all kinds of horrible things that happen in a marriage. Marriages that indicate, you know, that can make it really difficult. And it'll take away your happiness. And yet doesn't fall under the condition that Jesus gave for a divorce. There are all kinds of bad habits that you find out your spouse has that you didn't know about before you married him. You know, snoring. Even things laying around the house that just make you cringe. You should put them in the trash can. Think worse than that. There are character changes that take place sometimes in people that you didn't anticipate. Sometimes somebody becomes physically incapacitated because of some kind of, you know, unfortunate accident or something. There's abuse that can take place in a marriage that you never saw coming. None of those were given by God as a reason for divorce. I would even go as far as to say, even sometimes you can have a marriage where a husband will not allow a spouse to go worship. You know, that's a popular thing. I've read that's a reason to divorce. The Bible doesn't say that. Many situations in history where God's people were put in a situation where it was impossible for them to worship. Daniel lived in Babylon for a long time. He couldn't go to Jerusalem and worship. Ezekiel lived in captivity. He couldn't go to Jerusalem to worship. Paul was in prison for quite a bit of time in the New Testament. He couldn't go to church and worship, could he? Christians persecuted by Saul himself before he became a Christian, thrown in jail. They couldn't worship. We kind of live in, I'm going to tell you, we live in kind of 21st century America, and we assume that there's nobody in any condition where they can't do it, where they can't go and worship. And that's just not true. It's a way we've been taught. We've been taught that the local church, this thing here, what we have, is essential for our salvation. It's kind of an institutional concept that my salvation is tied inextricably to a membership on the role of a local church. Well, that's not always possible. There are times when God took away the elements of worship. If you go read the book of Joel, He took away the elements of worship so they could not even do the things that were necessary to worship. No wine, no grain. They had to serve God to the degree that was possible. We say, well, we must obey God rather than men, and we press that into service. But, you know, that's really not the truth. People can worship God the best that they can under the circumstances that He's given them. If it's possible, a person should be a part of an assembly. There ain't no bones about it. Okay? Don't misunderstand. That's what God commanded. But it just is not always a lot within the realm of possibility. It's happened many times in the world. So it's not about my happiness. Psalm 15 and verse 4. Psalm 15 and verse 4. He pronounced a blessing. Oops, I'm not doing a good job, am I? This is really bad. I didn't put the rest out. Psalm 15 verse 4 said, He pronounces a blessing. On a man who swears to his own hurt and does not change. Psalm 15 verse 4. Who can abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? And He gives a list of things there. He says in verse 4, in whose eyes the wicked are despised, but honor those who fear the Lord, who stand by their oath, even to their hurt. Stand by their oath, even to their hurt. Even to their hurt. Some of us have experienced the difficulty of making promises that are very hurtful to keep. Harder to keep than we ever thought they would be. Maybe simple as business deals that we got into where we thought we'd make money, instead it cost us money. But the blessing was pronounced on the person who entered the commitment and keeps it because he said he would, even if it ends up being damaging, even if it ends up killing him. Society would say what to that? They'd say, you are insane. You have got to be crazy. You have a right to be happy. Happiness is the be-all and end-all, really, of our society. People make bucket lists. Bucket lists are about making ourselves happy, about the things we'd like to do. And staying in a difficult marriage probably isn't in the bottom of many people's bucket lists. There's only one reason for divorce, one reason, Jesus said. The only exception was when there's sexual immorality. That's it. I'm saying having that kind of agreement with someone before you marry, knowing that that's where what they're committed to, will reduce the odds that we'll be involved in the train wreck that's happening. It will reduce the odds. It's not a guarantee. Because we are not in control and we don't know what will happen. Remember how much people leave their commitments and they forsake their commitments. But it will certainly reduce the likelihood. Well, in the face of divorce, sometimes things start going south. Any parents of children must face the possibility, for example, that things can go bad in the marriage of a child, no matter how hard they try to help them make good choices. What do you tell them? What would you tell them? They say, Mom, Dad, how can I save it? How can I rescue this situation? How can I preserve it? What would you tell them? Well, Matthew 5:38 through verse 41, turn there. Matthew 5 verse 3. How do you try to rescue a marriage that's going south? Here's what Jesus would say. If you can make the application. He would say, you've heard it said that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That kind of describes what happens in a marriage sometimes when it's going bad. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, verse 39, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever shall compel you to go 1 mile, go with him two, and give to him who asks, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Verse 43, you've heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. He tells us to do what makes the least sense from worldly wisdom. He says, you do what is right to that person. You do what is right. If you're going to improve that marriage, you're going to have to do the opposite of what most, probably some marriage counselors might tell you. Yep, Jesus would be crazy, but most people would say, that is insane. Turn the other cheek? You've got to be kidding me. You're out of your mind. Let myself be mistreated? No way. Allow that person to use me as a doormat? No self-respecting person would do it. Well, what did Jesus do? Philippians 2. To Philippians chapter 2. What did Jesus do? Paul was trying to teach these Christians who were having some conflict that they needed to be like-minded and have the same love. Verse 3, let nothing be done out of selfish ambition, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem the other better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also the interest of others. And then he illustrates that by using different people to illustrate that point. So, when he gets to verse 5, his first illustration is Jesus as the model. He says, let this mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, took on the form of a bondservant, came in the likeness of men, being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself, being obedient to the point of death, even the death on the cross. That's about as close to being a doormat as you possibly can get. Wouldn't you say? If ever a person could argue, no self-respecting person would let somebody do that to them. Jesus could argue that. He really could. He was in heaven. He lived with the Lord. Perfect environment. Excellent situation. He gave that up and came here. He gave up the form of glory he had and assumed a new form. Clothed with flesh, he became a man. And if that wasn't enough, he became a servant, took on the role of a servant. And not just a servant, but a servant who was an obedient servant, even to the point of giving up his life. That's kind of like a CEO going from that position to scrubbing toilets in a truck stop bathroom. If you want some kind of nasty image. That's just about, maybe you can come up with a worse one, but that's pretty scummy. That's about what Jesus did. Why did he do that? Why would he do that? John chapter 12, verse 32 says, and if I am lifted up from the earth, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. This he said, signifying by what death he would die. John 12, verse 32. He did that because that's the kind of love that opens hearts. The person that keeps mistreating me or treating me good, even when I don't deserve it, that makes me feel ashamed. It does. It makes me feel mad when somebody does good to me and I've been doing ill to them. It's the best chance of causing me to feel like I need to make some changes in my own life. To know I need to change and motivate you. Somebody says, what if they don't respond right? What if I don't convert them by doing that? Well, what if they just keep running over me? Well, God will take care of that. God will take care of that. That's what he said in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 29, when he said, of how much worse punishment do you suppose will be to him who will be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing and insulted the Spirit of grace. God will take care of that. He'll take care of vengeance. That will not be the end of the story for that person. But for our part, we're to be the ones who serve. Try to win them through the same kind of love that God used to win us. And we need to tell our kids, tell ourselves, if we're in that situation, we need to remember the Lord's will, that there's only one exception. There's only one exception He gave for divorce. Somebody says, I know that's what the text says, but surely it would be common sense that the Lord would understand my situation. Well, do we make a commitment? Do we trust the Lord's will? No matter what it seems it would do to us, regardless of the world's wisdom. I'll tell you what, the devil will have a much harder time doing damage to us, the damage that he wants to do, if we will follow God's plan in the face of divorce. It's just possible, if we trust God's wisdom above our own, that he can win that other person. But there's no guarantee. We do everything that we can. We tell our kids that they're in this way, you do what is right. You do what is right. It doesn't matter, because this is what the Lord said in the face of that. But what about if it doesn't happen? You know, it's happened now. There's a divorce. Maybe you did it, maybe they did it. What do you do now? Sometimes it happens when you don't want it to happen. What does the parent say to the child? Well, they would say what the Lord said, right? You need to do what's right. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, going back to our passage. Paul said, unto the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, as a husband is not to depart or to divorce his wife. Do what is right, is what you would say to that person under those terrible circumstances, even if I'm the one who did the damage. Say you divorced and you shouldn't have. That's what I'm proposing. You divorced and you shouldn't have. It's not unreal. It's real, but it's not lawful. You understand the difference? It's real. It happened, but it's not permitted. It's unlawful. It was unauthorized. God said, don't put asunder, and you did. So now what? Well, Paul would say, do what is right. First thing, you need to make up your mind to turn back to the Lord, to repent of what you've done, and do what is right. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, they did that. This congregation heard the words of Paul, and they responded to them correctly. He praised them in the second letter. He said, for godly sorrow produces repentance to salvation, not to be regretted, but the sorrow of the world produces death. For observe this very thing, that you sorrowed in a godly manner. What diligence it produced in you. What clearing of yourselves. What indignation. What fear. What vehement desire. What zeal. What vindication. In all things you have proved yourselves to be clear in this matter. So here are people who heard the message that Paul had wrote them, and they made up their minds to repent and do what was right in that face of that situation. You say, I'm sorry. I was wrong. Can we fix this? Can we reconcile this thing? It was not what God's will. It was unlawful. It was not permitted. What can we do to fix this? The situation will get better. Maybe not easier, but it will get better. At least from the standpoint of your own eternal destiny, it will get better. But even if you're not the one, suppose the damage was done to you. Suppose you've been the one who's been put away. Maybe you're innocent, maybe you weren't. What are you going to do? I hope you do what's right. You have to do the right thing. As the Lord defines what is right. Serve God with all your heart. Repent in the ways that's possible. Devote yourself totally to God with your whole heart. Do what's right. Last passage I want us to look at. Just look in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. As I read through this, thought about this circumstance, all these possible circumstances. Kept remembering, coming back to this, that we, you know, in the final analysis, we're not in control of a lot. A lot of things happen that are not in our control. Things that we want to happen don't always happen. Paul said in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and beginning verse 11, he said, "Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, or bread to the wise, or riches to the intelligent, or favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared at a time of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them." Sometimes things happen that we did not see coming. We did everything. We made the best decisions that we could, made the best judgment possible. Even with God's wisdom, we used to make those judgments. And things went wrong. It happens. The race is not always to the swift. The race is not always to the battle's not to the strong. The bread's not always to the wise. The riches to the intelligent. We aren't in control. We'd like to think we are. So we're going to have to put some things in the Lord's hands. After we do all that we can do to prevent certain problems, we have to deal with them anyway. And if our confidence and our peace of mind is dependent on how well I can keep things in control, then I probably won't have very much peace. The only thing at all that will bring peace to people that we studied about before is that regardless of what storm we face or epidemic, we're going to do what God says. It's the only thing that's under our control, really, is we need to be committed to do what God says at all costs. Do what is right. Trust the outcome to God. And then we can put our head on the pillow and sleep. We live in a society where things are out of control. It's a train. It's going to wreck. But we don't have to be a part of that train wreck. We don't have to be. God has given us a lot of wisdom. He's given us the ability to make careful choices and trust in Him and let Him help us in those kind of things. And so these are just suggestions, things to think about. As I thought about our study in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it's not a very pleasant study. Not at all. Paul was trying to prevent things that were happening in the Lord's church and in His temple that were happening all around them in society. He wanted to stop that, to prevent that. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's what we're shooting for here too. We want prevention. We want this to be a place that's the exception to the rule as it's becoming more and more in our society. But to do that, we have to commit ourselves to God wholeheartedly, 100%. Let Him, His wisdom, guide us and determine which direction we go, and trust in Him more than we do ourselves. And you begin that by trusting in Jesus, turning to Him, recognizing that God's love for you and His personal interest in your salvation and your well-being was demonstrated powerfully on a cross 2,000 years ago. And it didn't begin then. It began thousands of years before when He began working out His plan so that one day He could make it possible for you to have a relationship with Him. That's love that's unparalleled. And so here's this God who sacrificed everything for you, sent His Son to die for you, spoken to us, given us His wisdom on how to, on every subject that pertains to life and godliness in this world. And He asked for us to respect Him as the Creator who has that wisdom and to respond by being conforming to His will, trusting in Him and walking His way. This morning, becoming a Christian would be a great beginning to that. Becoming a Christian involved deciding to choose God's way and not my way, turning to Him, turning to the one that maybe we've offended by things that we've done, choices we've made, and seeking His forgiveness. That forgiveness is available through the blood of His Son. Doing what He asked us to do to take advantage of those blessings, being baptized for the forgiveness of our sins, making a commitment to serve Him with all of our heart, whether it's in our marriages or our workplace or whatever area of life. Would you do that this morning? It's a heavy decision. It's worth everything that you have to sacrifice in order to gain that. Because Jesus said one time, what does a man profit if he gains the whole world and he loses his own soul? You can gain that salvation, the thing that matters the most right now, if you'll do it, while we stand and sing our song.